Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. As we mentioned just before the news, earlier this morning I got to interview Mayor Bloomberg at a Crain's New York business breakfast. The mayor agreed to sit down with Crain's editor Greg David and me in front of about 700 people at the Sheraton Hotel Ballroom in Midtown. He began with some prepared remarks about education, and between that and his new nonpartisan independence and the upcoming congestion pricing deadline and more, there was a lot to talk about. And this is, of course, a very interesting moment to talk to the mayor at length. So here's our interview. Again, the other questioner is Greg David, managing editor of Crain's New York Business.
Mr. Mayor, as you mentioned, the key to these changes in the New York City school system has been mayoral control. But mayoral control of the schools expires in 2009. When will you seek renewal of that legislation, or do you intend to leave it to your successor to set up the governance of the schools for the future?
The law expires in June of 2009, and I will have roughly 6 months left to go in my term. And I plan to work very hard before those 6 months, and hopefully won't have to do it afterwards. But if necessary, I'll be there to do it, to convince the legislature that this is the right thing to do. And I think you will get it done if the results are there. It's hard for the legislature to not reauthorize something where parents say, my kids, for the first time in memory, are getting the kind of education they need to compete in the world. And it would be very hard for a legislature to look them in the eye and say, no, no, let's go back to the old days of patronage and failure and of walking away from kids who aren't as lucky as some others, don't happen to come from families of two-parent families or families with wealth or families where education is a tradition. That's the challenge of this school system. It's easy to educate those where the support group at home is there for them. Remember, the teachers only have students for 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, 26 weeks a year, something like that. It's the parents that really have the job of teaching values and making sure the children learn outside of school most of their lives, realize the things that they need. And the parents are going to understand, and I think are starting to do that already. This really is a sea change in how to run a public school system. And I'm not here to preach about the rest of the country, but I can't tell you how proud I am for the job that we have done here. It is Walcott, it is Klein, it is all the people that work at the Department of Education. It is the principals, it is the teachers, it's the parents, it's the students, it's the custodians, it's the school crossing guards, it's the taxpayers and the legislature, all of whom gave it. It's everything coming together. And, you know, success has 1,000 fathers. I hope we have 2,000 fathers because we want more success.
One of the major criticisms of your regime here has been that it just doesn't include enough parental advice and consent. Are there any changes in the law that you would consider which would allow a stronger role for parents?
You know, in business, if you have something that's doing as well as this, defying all expectations, you'd be hard-pressed to understand why you wouldn't keep going. Maybe you want to double up, but you certainly don't want to run any risks of getting rid of some of the things that work. I think when it comes to parents' involvement, it's not fair to say that Walcott and Klein haven't included parents. Quite the contrary. They've put parent coordinators in every single school, 14-odd hundred people, whose only job it is to interface with the parents and the teachers and the principals and to make sure that they can dialogue, pass on a message, set up a meeting. You go to schools, you can get the cell phone number of the parent coordinator. And for the first time, parents have the ability to really find out what the teacher thinks their student needs or to tell the teacher what the situation is at home and what extra help the student might need in the classroom. Before, we had this elected group where it was just a patronage thing where people were using it as a stepping stone and certainly were not doing the job that a professional parent coordinator are doing today. Teachers should run the classroom with direction from the principals, not parents. Teachers are the trained professionals, the best in the country. The 80,000 school teachers we have really are superior as a group to any group you'll put together in the public or private sector. It's really quite amazing how many good teachers. I'll give you a story. When we came into office, 12,000 teachers quit or retired every year, and we had trouble filling those slots. The base is about 80,000 teachers. 12,000 quit. We couldn't find 12,000 certified teachers. Today, all teachers are certified, required by state law, but we managed to get those teachers. We have only 5,000 teachers quitting or retiring each year. In this past year, we had 70,000 applicants from around the country wanting to come here. We have the best and the brightest, and we're continuing to get the best of the brightest. And I want our teachers and our principals to run the classrooms the way they see fit, the way they were trained to do, and to work with the parents so the parents can do what their responsibility is and what they're trained to do, namely give the kid an awful lot more instruction than teachers ever will all those hours when the child is not in the classroom.
Mr. Mayor, you mentioned the new funding formula with the same amount of money per capita per student going to each school. I realize it would be more in the case of special needs students. But with so many business people in the room this morning, I'm sure some of them are thinking about that and wondering, well, will that give principals the incentive to hire cheaper, therefore less experienced teachers? And if so, what would the implications of that be?
That's up to the principal. That's the whole idea of delegation. We're going to let the principals make the decision. Would they rather have a young, inexperienced, enthusiastic employee or somebody that has been around and understands the system a little bit better and has more experience? And I think in my organization, I always want a balance. I want some that believe anything's possible and some that know that you have to work within the system and you're not going to get it done overnight. But that all at the same time. But that's up to the principal.
But wouldn't it mean, since pay is based on seniority, fewer teachers if you're going to hire the more experienced teachers and therefore a higher student-teacher ratio?
Look, nobody is going to have a higher student-teacher ratio. You're talking about extra number of teachers at the margin. And no principal is going to go in and overnight change the character of its school. What you really have here is for the first time in those neighborhoods where the parents don't know how to pull the levers of power, where their schools have been chronically underfunded by $2,000 or $3,000 a year per capita, those teachers with CFE money, those schools, those principals will now have the wherewithal to do what they need to do. If they want another science lab, if they want more books, if they want to have a teacher who trains other teachers, if they want to have a teacher who works just with kids who need extra help, that's up to the principals. And I don't think, Brian, you or me or Greg, any of us, have the ability, nor should we be given the responsibility to do that, and the legislature shouldn't either. That's why you have professionals who know what they're doing, and you see the results.
Mr. Mayor, you mentioned things you would like to do, including changes to tenure and more incentives for teachers to do better, to work in difficult schools, et cetera. But the contract you signed with the United Federation of Teachers lasts, I believe, for the rest of your term. So how is it going to be possible to get changes given that the teachers' contract is settled?
I think we've had three, or maybe it's four, certainly three at least, contracts with the UFT since I came into office. Every time the teachers got a raise in compensation, total is 43% on average, and remember there's merit pay and performance pay for principals and there's some other things for teachers, there's a whole variety of separate things, but fundamentally, teachers' salaries have gone up 43%. Why? Because I said when I came into office, number one priority, do something about education. I think there's no social problem we have that wouldn't be eliminated or ameliorated if we had a better educated student body. But in return for all of those raises, I think it's fair to say that we negotiated with the UFT fundamental changes in management's ability to run the school system rather than have the UFT run the school system. And the UFT, every time, the membership has approved the contract, so they must think that it's okay. Remember, the teachers' union's job is to get more money and better working conditions for their members. Nothing wrong with that. The city's job is to get a better educational product for our students. And that's a very healthy balance, and we've negotiated, and I think in all fairness, the UFT has been very well led. And over the years, you know, everybody wants to start a war between Randy and me, but the truth of the matter is, when we have breakfast every once in a while at my favorite Greek diner, we always seem to come to a resolution. Jim Hanley, who runs labor relations, and Joel Klein, Dennis Walcott, Pam Silverblatt, they've all worked with the UFT, and it's been a good balance. They get more money, we get more control, and the results are there. 20% up in graduation rate, 20% up in math, and crime down. More teachers wanting to come here. I can't think of a better verification of the fact that we are working well together. And I might point out that the CSA, the Principals Union, with Ernie Logan, is also well run now. And we've come to a contract. It took us 3 or 4 years without a contract with the CSA. But they weren't willing to do what we needed, and so we didn't get what we want, and they didn't get paid. And when they decided to come to the table and we sat down, we negotiated together, they got something and we got something.
Mr. Mayor, you mentioned in your remarks that black and Hispanic students are leading the way in the improvement, closing the gap. That's really important. The federal No Child Left Behind Act is also designed to help close that gap. Do you think No Child Left Behind is helping, hurting, or having no effect on your efforts?
Well, I think first you have to give President Bush a lot of credit for at least trying to do something about education. You might not agree with every part of No Child Left Behind, but if there's any issue in this country that we should focus on at a national level, it is education. I think we're doing a good job in New York City, but I don't think any study shows that our children across this country are being prepared for the competitive technological world, the international world that we are entering right now. And No Child Left Behind is trying to address that. Bill Bennett, many years ago, probably 20 years ago, I'll never forget, told me one time there was an issue about national testing. And he said, it will never happen. And I said, why? And Bill said, because the Republicans will never sign on to anything with the word national in it, and the Democrats won't sign on to anything with the word testing in it. Fortunately, at least today, 20 years later, Bill's being proved wrong. He's a very smart guy. I think that the problem is that we are unwilling to really stand up and say, testing should mean testing. We should have the same standards across this country. We live in a world where a child in the other 49 states is going to face the same competition that a child in our state does. And there, unfortunately, the way the law is written at the moment, no matter how well-meaning it is, or it was, there's a tendency to dumb down. There's a tendency to pass the tests even if you fudge the results or make the test easier in order to get the money. That's not a good idea. Now, there's always pressure, remember, here in the city still, even with these results. There are people that say we're teaching to the test. My answer to that is if the test is, can you read, that's exactly what we're supposed to be doing. Can you add 2 plus 2? If that's the test, you betcha we're going to teach to that test. But the bottom line is higher standards, more accountability, more expectations lead to better results. It does it in the private sector. It does it in the public sector. It does it in the philanthropic sector. There's no secrets here. You want results, raise the standards to get the federal monies. And the problem is, with our democracy, some places aren't willing to do that. And if you want to make No Child Left Behind better, that's fundamentally what you do.
A quick follow-up on testing. I interviewed Randy Weingarten last week, and she said teachers are now spending an average of 20% of their time on test prep. And she says that's too much because, yes, more students may be able to add 2 plus 2, but the richness of education is being lost.
Well, I don't know about the richness of education. In my other life, I have a business, and I can tell you, being able to do 2 plus 2 is a lot more important than a lot of other things. And I'm not trying to take away the interest we have in the arts and music and getting a well-rounded education and thinking and being able to couch a problem in the right terms and understand an answer and ask a question and work collaboratively and collectively. All of those things are important. But I think I disagree with Randy. I think all of that preparation for the test, given you don't know the answers, is exactly what you need. Think about it. Every one of you in this room, when you had to study for the test, you had to learn how to add because you couldn't get through the test unless you did. Adding is a useful skill to have.
Mayor Bloomberg, in defense of adding, part of the interview that I did with him along with Crane's New York business editor Greg David this morning at a Crane's breakfast at the Sheraton Hotel. We'll continue with part two of that interview in just a minute. We'll go on to congestion pricing, immigration, and the presidential race and political parties. And then we'll take your phone calls reacting to any of it. That'll be in about 20 minutes that you'll be able to call in and talk on the air about this. 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up tomorrow morning for the day after the last day of school in New York City, we will have Schools Chancellor Joel Klein, and you know we'll follow up on some of the things we were just talking to Mayor Bloomberg about. And we will also have the New York City Council Speaker, Christine Quinn, tomorrow morning. A lot to listen for every morning at 10 a.m. Now back to the Sheraton Hotel Metropolitan Ballroom, where this morning Greg David, the editor of Crane's New York Business, and I interviewed Mayor Bloomberg after his 15-minute speech about education. We next go on to congestion pricing. Here's Greg David's question.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to move to the hot-button issue of the moment, congestion pricing. The Transit Authority said this week that there's no room on the numbered subway lines for any new riders that would head to the subways if congestion pricing went into effect. Doesn't that lend support to the opponent's view that we're just not ready for congestion pricing?
Let me just understand this. So we'll do nothing about improving mass transit, and they'll say that's the solution to the problem? I don't think so. I think the guy, number one, if you want to fix the problem, if the subways are that crowded, and incidentally, I take the Lex most days, and it's not that crowded, so you stand up next to people. Get real. This is New York. What's wrong with that? I mean, you know, and people that criticize, let me make a defense. I'll get in trouble. I protected Con Ed. Now I'm going to protect the MTA. When I came to New York City in 1966, the subways were filthy. They were panhandlers. There was graffiti all over the place. They broke down. They weren't air-conditioned. I would suggest all of you take the subway with me today or tomorrow. You will find every one of those things different. It's a great ride. It gets you where you want to go quickly, safely, cleanly. And I can think of only once that somebody ever yelled at me on the subway. This guy yelled at me, "Fix the Knicks." Okay, I can do a lot of things.
Mr. Mayor.
But seriously, if you want, we have to. Here's the problem in New York City. The air we breathe is getting worse. There's a global warming issue. We're just a small part of it, but we should do our share. And I don't believe one of these things, wait till the other guy does it. New York City, of all places, should be leading by example. You see if the smoking ban, what we've done.
Mr. Mayor, the deal on the table in Albany, which didn't pass, would have called for a study commission that would have decided whether to implement congestion pricing in 2008
okay,
or later.
Study.
Is that deal, which didn't even pass, acceptable to you when the legislature goes back in July?
The what is acceptable to this city is to let us do a pilot project. The key is the word pilot. 2 or 3 years after we do some mass transit improvements, implement it, then the legislature can take a look at it and decide whether or not to go ahead. Legislatures shouldn't try to micromanage their design. Legislative oversight is to work on big concepts. This is a big concept. It's something that's been tried elsewhere and has a reasonable chance of working here. And now's the time to try it. I think we've studied enough. There are some parts of it where you can study, and I don't have any objections to that, but the technology and where it goes and what the charges should be, the fundamental building blocks of congestion pricing should be up to the city. We should be in charge of our own destiny. And, yes, the state does have the right to give us to say yay or nay, and I think that's why the pilot is the right answer. We'll do the best we can and then see what happens. You know, if you take a look, history will write a book, somebody will write a book, Caro or somebody like that, will say Dokhtarov had a bigger impact on this city than the last big builder that came to the city, who lived in, incidentally, an awful lot easier time. Didn't have the courts, didn't have community boards, didn't have all of the visibility that we have today. And Dan's done the study. He's had experts that we've included. Every single advocacy group, whether it's traffic or environment, pros and cons, left and rights, out borough, inner borough, everybody. They've come up with a plan that we think has a reasonable chance of working, and I think we need to do it, and we need to do it for a couple of very simple reasons. Our kids in many neighborhoods are going to the hospital with four times the asthma rate of the national average. Can't sit here and say to a parent, well, let's do another study while your kid's breathing this air. You want to go and look that parent in the eye? I don't think so. And we are hurting business in this city. I don't know how many of you have tried to get across town, but even in the midday, you fundamentally have to schedule your meetings so far apart that you, because you're never sure whether it's going to be a quick ride or a slow ride. You want to know why your plumber charges $60 an hour? Part of the answer is he can't get to your job because he's spending all his time sitting in traffic. So we've got to do something about traffic, which is hurting our economy. We've got to do something about cleaning the air. And we've got to do something about the long-term solution to transportation in this city, and that's mass transit. And anybody that thinks we're going to discover money all of a sudden is sadly mistaken. If the stock market and the deals business were to slow down, Wall Street profits will slow down. That would hurt our tax revenues. Housing prices stop going up. That doesn't help. There are all these clouds on the horizon, and I'm an optimist. I think the world's going to be fine, and New York City's going to be fine. We have to prepare what not. What if that doesn't happen? We are building a Second Avenue subway. We just had the fourth groundbreaking for a Second Avenue subway, and we don't have the money to finish it. Where do you think the money's going to come from? We have big parts of the city, Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Staten Island, where there's no mass transit. These are taxpayers. These are people who live in the city. We want them to come in by mass transit. They get there a lot quicker. They get there a lot more efficiently, and they wouldn't be polluting there. But somebody's got to provide the mass transit. Where's the money going to come from? And lots of people have ideas on how to come up with money for mass transit. Tax everybody. Okay, maybe that's the solution, but it doesn't accomplish the other thing, which is cleaning the air and reducing congestion. Lots of people have ideas how to clean the air and reduce congestion, but it doesn't give us the money for mass transit. Congestion pricing does both, and it's an idea whose time has come, and I will say I'm optimistic. We'll see what happens, but I'm optimistic that Albany will do what is the right thing, because I think really deep down inside you're going to find, and I'll stand up for all three of them, whether it's Joe, Shelley, or Elliot, together, they, I think, I hope, will come up with an agreement to get this done, and the timing is now or never, because we have a chance, and thanks to Washington, to get $400 or $500 million, which would pay for a lot of the mass transit improvements in advance of putting in the charge and pay for the infrastructure. And if we miss this opportunity, shame on us. Probably none of us here today will still be alive the next time this comes up, and anybody's got the courage to do it.
Governor Corzine also has a concern about transit. He said that New Jersey transit would be overwhelmed.
Yeah, I talked to him. Number one, I don't know why you want to say your transit system can be overwhelmed, but here's the issue for New Jersey, and I talked to John. It's not an issue. There's 65,000 cars that come from New Jersey into the city. Our estimate is that the congestion pricing will probably only reduce that by a couple of thousand, which means the trivial number, 2,000 or 3,000 more people on their mass transit, which given the number of ways to get here by mass transit, you wouldn't even notice. But the reason that New Jersey doesn't reduce the number of cars coming into the city is the congestion pricing plan lets you offset tolls that you pay to get into Manhattan against the congestion pricing charge. So if you come from New Jersey, you're already paying the money. There's no economic incentive for you to come in from New Jersey via mass transit rather than by cars. The ways to get New Jerseyans to come into the city is to build another tunnel, which would make a very big difference. And whether this money goes to that or this money allows the Port Authority to put monies there that they would have otherwise had to do things, it is a win-win for New Jersey. And I explained that to John. It is not going to overstress their mass transit system. Quite honestly, I wish it would, but it's not going to.
Mr. Mayor, you recently said that you recently vowed not to leave your successor with a budget mess like the one you inherited. What did Rudy Giuliani do wrong?
I don't know that Rudy Giuliani did anything wrong. Rudy just happened to finish his term after two things had happened. One, if you go back and look, the middle of 2000, the internet bubble came crashing down, and that had an enormous impact on Wall Street profits, which is one of our big revenue generators. It had an impact on people buying luxury goods and paying sales tax. That's another big thing that we have, an impact on real estate transactions. So the first big thing that happened, that Rudy just happened to be here at the end and that I inherited, was the end of the internet bubble. And if you go back and just chart out on your Bloomberg terminal, I'm sure all of you have them, just look at the S&P 500, and you'll see that it started to come down starting in the middle of 2000, and 9/11 really wasn't that much of an impact on the national economy. There was a blip, the stock market went down. It actually came right back, but the overall trend kept coming down, and Rudy had to deal with that. And then there was the 9/11 catastrophe, and that hurt the city's economy much more than it hurt the national economy, and Rudy had to deal with that as well, and then I inherited it. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you look at the city as a financial model of the city, we have variable revenues and fixed expenses. In fact, it's a little bit worse than that because they're built-in inflators in our fixed expenses. And it's not like a business where you can go out of a product line. Governments fundamentally can't do that. Only with great pain and in terrible, terrible times can you do that. So what happened to Rudy and happened to the Bloomberg administration, and I hope it doesn't happen to our successors, is that revenues came crashing down and the expenses kept slowly drifting up. And nobody saves money for the future. What I've tried to do is to fund debt service for the next few years, roll as much money as I can into fiscal 09, which doesn't start until for a year from July 1st, and into fiscal 2010, so that my successor will not have that problem. We've also tried to start funding a $50 billion liability, which our city has. We have funded our pension system, but we have another liability which would even survive bankruptcy, and that is health care benefits for past and current municipal employees. And all of a sudden, the accounting boards are making cities and states estimate the number. Nobody's making them fund it. The estimate for New York City is $50 billion. That's what we need in a trust fund. Well, we've put in $2.5 billion, but at least it's a start going towards that, and I hope my successor doesn't take the money out and spend it. If it was really an emergency, I suppose you'd have to. But everybody thinks the good times are never going to end. And what I'm trying to do is to have labor contracts that are fair, that will keep our workforce growing, people wanting to work here, will keep them flexible and willing to work hard and happy. No organization works without a good, happy workforce, and you'll never make them all happy. You'll never get enough, but fundamentally, you can make the workforce want to work here. And so I want long-term labor contracts going into the future, particularly through the next election, so it's the labor contracts are not a factor in the next election, which I think is a bad idea. I don't want labor going and trying to say, I'll support you if you promise to give us a labor contract going forward. So we're working on that. And we've had very good relations with the labor unions in this city, but also fund those things and the outlying budget gaps. People that say, oh, you always say, Mayor, we're going to have budget gaps, and they never arrive. Just remember when we came into office, we had $5, $6 billion budget gaps. We raised taxes 18%. Anybody wants to do that and then do a parade past a bunch of homeowners, I'll tell you, it's a character-building experience if you ever needed one, particularly if you put a smoking ban in at the same time. And we've raised taxes. We got the state to take over Big Mac financing, $2.7 billion, as I remember, of debt service. I don't know whether it's good or bad economics for the state, but it was certainly good for the city. And when people tell me that Joe and Shelley weren't there for us, let me tell you, they were there for us when we needed it. In that case, over the veto of Governor Pataki, who didn't think it was good economics, probably right, but nevertheless, I wanted it done. The state has been there, and we've made the hard choices. We've had a hiring freeze. We've had programs to eliminate the gap. We've cut. We've made choices. Bad times do come, and we've got to get ready for the bad times in the future.
Mr. Mayor, Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno said yesterday that Governor Spitzer is acting like a third-world dictator and that you'd make a great president. Do you agree with Bruno on either count?
Well, the second part, I'm mayor and going to continue to be mayor for the next roughly 920 days. On the first, I suspect this is just Albany with, there's a lot of theatrics that go on in Albany all the time. In the end, Joe Bruno, Shelley Silver, and Elliot Spitzer will come together, and I hope sooner rather than later, but they will come together. They will each get part of what they want, not as much as what they want. That's what democracy is all about. And I think this state will be well served by having the three of them in office. And I really do think that it's the three of them provide a healthy balance between different points of view and let it all play out. The press wants a story. Cranes wants to write something. You want to talk about something. But the bottom line is they keep getting us from here to there, and I hope they continue to do it. And they've been very good for this city.
A big issue between them right now is campaign finance reform. Senator Bruno doesn't want LLCs to lose their exemption from the campaign finance limits. Do you have a position on this?
I think this is up to the state. I'm not going to get involved in that. I worked very hard on campaign finance reform with Chris Quinn here in the city. I think we got legislation passed, or it's about to be passed, that nobody would have expected us to do it. It's not perfect. I would have preferred to include labor unions in there, but I just couldn't get that far. Chris Quinn deserves a lot of credit for standing up, and as does, I guess, the rest of the city council, and doing something that if I told you a year ago you would have done in the city, you'd say impossible.
Mr. Mayor, isn't that the crucial issue with campaign finance reform? You've agreed to practically completely abolish campaign finance contributions from members of this audience who do any business in the city. Meanwhile, labor unions, equally interested in city policy, can continue to give large amounts of money.
Greg,
Don't you think it's just going to unbalance it and give labor a very strong hand in local politics?
Look, if you take a look at how much money labor gives, it's really not very much money when you add it up. I mean, this is one of the great straw men of all times. The difference, I think, with labor is you know where the unions are coming from. You know what business they do with the city. As a matter of fact, you can even get the contract with the city. Just foil it and you'll be able to get it. So we know what the labor unions are trying to do. Yes, I said I would have preferred to include them in it, but you just the practical reality is I couldn't get that done. And I think not having some reform because we can't get everything just is letting the perfect get in the way of the good. Maybe you come back and do it. But at least in terms of the disclosure part, you know where labor unions stand and exactly what they want. And a big part of all campaign finance reform is not so much limiting money. It is making sure the public knows who is funding each candidate and what that person wants from that candidate. So then we, in a democracy, can hold that candidate accountable and say, okay, I understand whether you gave it to him because of the merits or whether you gave it to him because they helped you. But disclosure is the biggest part, and at least with the unions, disclosure is not an issue.
On the immigration debate before Congress right now, New York business leaders I've spoken with have told me they tend to be against the bill because they fear a labor shortage in the city from the new points system and limited guest worker program. How much do you share that concern, and do you urge the New York delegation to vote one way or another?
Well, I think it's a very big concern. We have to have immigrants. We need the 12 million immigrants who are here. Number one, you couldn't deport them if you wanted. Number two, it would devastate our economy. And number three, while it is true they're here by breaking the law, it's also true that the federal government was complicit in letting them do it. We, since 1986, the last immigration reform, have deliberately turned a blind eye. So let's not go just whip the immigrants. We can whip ourselves and then say, let's get on with it. You want to give permanent status to 12 million. Number two, I mean, I look around the audience and none of you are remotely close to wanting to collect your Social Security. But if you were a lot older and did want to collect your Social Security, you better pray that we take a lot of immigrants into this country, because with the birth rate that we have, there are not going to be enough people to pay Social Security. It's a very big problem for this country. It's an even bigger problem in Japan and in Europe and in China, where they have the one-child policy. Who's going to fund our retirement? Only people who are going to get to do that are immigrants. Number three, this country and our economy and our culture is built on a constant influx of new ideas and new things and new ways of looking at it and people that have the guts to get up and move around the world to have a better life for themselves and their families. To not take in 400,000 or 500,000 immigrants would be devastating for this country. And then you get down to the businesses. There's no question that every company that deals with technology and lots of other industries, companies that just use like agriculture, where it's the not intellectual content you want, it's the sweat kind of content, that we need to have those kinds of people come in. And 200,000 people is much too few. Having said all of that, you got to get some bill. And the alternative, if we say this is not a perfect bill because it doesn't do X, Y, or Z, you don't have preferences for families, you don't have this, you don't have that, 200,000 is too few, the alternative is to leave us in this never-never land where we're, in theory, employers are supposed to hold to check and see whether or not the people they hire are legal, but there's no ways to do that because the cards are all faked and you don't have any biometrics so that they can't do their job. And that means so many people try to come across borders that we have no control of our borders in a world post 9/11 where we really do have a security issue. You got to get this done. And on balance, the Senate bill, the way it's proposed, and who knows what's going to be added, and who knows what the House is going to do. But if you ask me, if I were in Congress today, I would vote for the bill that Kennedy has put up.
Mr. Mayor, since coming into office, you've been a strong supporter of extending the convention and tourism industry by expanding the Javits Center. But the plan to expand the Javits Center seems likely to die amid complaints about how much it costs and how little space it's going to provide. What can be done to break the logjam that is delaying this project?
Well, I talked to Governor Spitzer yesterday about the Javits Center by accident. I always eat my heart out when I drive in from the airport in Chicago and you see what a beautiful convention center could be. We could have had something like that on the west side, and we didn't. So, okay, let's get on with what we can do now. The trouble is we want a bigger, better center, and we don't have the money to pay for a bigger, better convention center after a certain limit. So the Spitzer administration and our administration's working together. We're taking another last look at whether or not this plan is worth the money, whether or not the impact on the development of that whole area, which might be devastated if we slowed things down and changed, whether that would be worth it. And we'll get back to you in a short period of time. But Elliot and I have our staffs working together on it, and I did talk to him about it yesterday.
We have time for two last questions.
And mine is political. Now that you have left the Republican Party, as I look at the major issues of the day, is part of the audience going to boo as well?
We have diversity in the audience. That's healthy. That's why you should be in the middle.
It is New York. As I look at the major issues of the day, though, it's clear what some of the issues are that you disagree with the National Republican Party on: guns, gay rights, abortion rights. But what about the Democrats? Can you point out any major issue differences with, let's say, Senator Schumer or Senator Clinton, or are you pretty much like a mainstream Democrat in your views?
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with partisanship. Let me first say that Senators Schumer and Clinton have been great senators as far as I'm concerned. My measure is you pick up the phone, you need something from Washington, do they take the call quickly, do they agree with you, and do they go out and lobby and try to get past the legislation that we in the city need or the allocations that we need in an appropriation bill. And I talked to Chuck yesterday. I talked to Hillary last week on two different issues, where yesterday Chuck asked me to work on something, and Hillary the week before, either I asked her or she asked me, I forget. So we work very well with them. I don't agree with your fundamental premise. I don't think that I disagree with what any national party stands for, because I don't think that either national party stands for anything. I think the people in those parties stand for things. There isn't any philosophy for a party. When's the last time you saw the platform of either party be tracked out and say, oh, we said 3 years ago at our convention, this is what we stand for? Come on, get serious. That's just to give you something to write about in the middle of a boring convention. There's nothing else. There are people from the far left to the far right in both parties. There are people who I agree with on all of these issues, social issues that you mentioned, and on international issues. And if you want to find somebody in the party that you disagree with, easy to do. You want to find somebody you agree with, easy to do. I think that what this city and this country and this state need is a nonpartisan approach to looking at the results. And I've given this speech before. I just did one with Schwarzenegger and Villaraigosa out in Los Angeles talking about why state and local governments are stepping in. The federal government, you can overstate it, but generally speaking, they really have gridlock. They can't look at the major issues of our day, crime on the streets and getting guns out of the hands of criminals. Not guns out of the hand of hunters or people that have a license, but we have federal laws that say you can't sell guns to criminals, and we do, and we're not stopping that. Education, I talked about what we're doing. Education.
Mr. Mayor, we only have, I would like to get one last question in. Before, when we announced that you were coming to this breakfast, I was stopped by 30 people who asked me what we talk about. They asked me, gave me questions. Not one of them wanted me to ask about education. Not one of them even brought up congestion pricing.
I'm sure.
They all had the same question, are you running for president? At what point does all this concentration on your running for president impair your ability to lead the city?
Number one, I'm not running for president. I'm going to be mayor for the next 920 days. I think the speculation is, all kidding aside, yes, you like to see your name in the paper. If you didn't, and if people say he'd make a great president and you didn't get a smile on your face, you ought to go see a shrink. But I think what you're seeing is a reflection of people's dissatisfaction with the gridlock and the way this country is going. They don't want to focus on flag burning and Terry Schiavo and things like that. They want solutions to immigration and crime. And
Mayor Bloomberg, at the end of a joint interview conducted by Greg David, Crane's New York business editor, and myself at a Crane's breakfast at the Sheraton this morning.